Baseball is in full swing. NBA playoffs are heating up, and your NFL team is gearing up for training camp. Listen to the latest on the teams you love here on the Odyssey app. The biggest sports radio stations in the country, providing unrivaled local coverage of their teams, all in one place. Exclusive interviews with players, coaches, and team executives, streaming live and always available on demand. Stay in the know with your favorite teams right here on the Odyssey app.
Worried about letting someone else pick out the perfect avocado for your perfect impress them on the third date guacamole? Well, good thing Instacart shoppers are as picky as you are. They find ripe avocados like it's their guac on the line. They are milk expiration date detectives. They bag eggs like the 12 precious pieces of cargo they are. So let Instacart shoppers overthink your groceries so that you can overthink what you'll wear on that third date. Download the Instacart app to get free delivery on your first three orders while supplies last. Minimum $10 per order. Additional terms apply.
Every weekday at this time, we explore a topic that's making news in our state. This is the State of California.
And good afternoon. I'm Doug Sovereign, KCBS political reporter and host of The State of California, sponsored by Meristem, along with Patty Rising and Jeff Bell.
Yeah, the coronavirus pandemic continues to rage across California and the nation, with a caseload climbing and reopening put on hold in many states.
Here in California, Governor Newsom said people largely obeyed the social distancing and mask regulations over the July 4th weekend, but the virus is still spreading, with more counties ordered to pull back on reopening today.
Well, Patty and Jeff, we're going to speak about the pandemic with Dr. Anthony Fauci, the director of the National Institute of Allergy and Infectious Diseases at the NIH, perhaps the most visible member of President Trump's coronavirus task force. He's going to join us live in just a few moments for an extended interview. There's a lot to ask him about. The virus seems to be spreading unchecked, but the death rate is dropping. Here in California, there's a record level of testing now, but that doesn't account entirely for the rising number of positive tests, because the rate at which people are testing positive continues to rise to alarming levels. And as hospitalization and ICU rates keep going up, some hospitals are becoming more and more stressed. In some counties, they're even overwhelmed, the hardest hit areas. We'll be joined by Dr. Fauci in the next minute or two, and he will stay with us to answer our questions. For most of the next half hour, we're going to break format and extend the State of California today. But in the meantime, Patty and Jeff, we can talk a little more about what the governor had to say today.
Yeah, Doug, the governor seems to be moving to a more fluid day-to-day response towards the COVID-19 pandemic with his evolving watch list and daily adjustments. Was that inevitable, and do you see that being the model moving forward?
I do think they've had to adjust. You know, there was a point, three, 4 weeks ago, when they thought this thing was on the wane, we'd bent the curve, let's reopen, maybe even more than 3 or 4 weeks, and they started to scale back his briefings. Then things started to take a turn for the worse, and we saw the cases climb, and the counties have to stop, and the governor's returned to daily briefings most days. He took Friday off, but they started this watch list, and now we've got almost half the counties on the watch list in California. So he's having to adjust his response. But let's talk a little bit more about the response in California and elsewhere, because I think we do now have Dr. Anthony Fauci joining us, director of the National Institute of Allergy and Infectious Diseases, on the KCBS Newsline. Dr. Fauci, thank you so much for taking some time to be with us this afternoon.
Thank you for having me. Good to be with you.
First, I just want to start with maybe your sense of where we are in this pandemic. Many of us thought that by now we would be coming out of this thing, but in so many parts of the country, and certainly here in California, the exact opposite is happening. How much do you think that's because of community transmission as we reopen the economy? Is that what you think the primary culprit is right now?
Yeah. Yes, I do, and I'm not alone in this. I mean, if you look at the situation of how the cases are rising, you know, it isn't the kind of thing that we saw when they were quite focused, traceable increases. These are clearly increases at the community level. You know, if you look at what's gone on, that, you know, Texas, California, Arizona, and Florida are accounting for 55% of all of the new cases that we're seeing over the last couple of days. So it really is focused in certain cases, in certain states. And it almost certainly is a predominance of community spread, which makes it all the more problematic, because it's much more difficult to do the kind of contact tracing isolation when you have community spread that is driven in part by people who are asymptomatic. So that's the real issue that we have here, which is obviously very frustrating and in many respects rather alarming.
So originally, public health officials always thought that the numbers would go up when the shelter-in-place orders started easing. But this seemed to catch everyone off guard. Where were the models off?
You know, as I've always said, and it's something that's painful to me to keep reminding, is that models are only as good as the assumptions that you put into the model. And when the assumptions change and you get them a bit wrong, it could have a real negative effect on the accuracy of what you're projecting. I mean, obviously, what we've seen, and, you know, you don't want to have blame on this or pointing fingers because it's just, it is what it is that when people come out and even when the direction from above, from the governors, from the mayors, are important and accurate directions, when people on their own feel it's either an all or none phenomenon. And that's the thing I think we need to get away from and pause and start to really reflect on. It isn't either lockdown or the devil may care. I mean, the best tool to a safe opening and getting the country back is by doing it in a measured, prudent way. But that's not what we're seeing in certain parts of the country where we're seeing these surges, and that's really unfortunate. I think we've got to use the public health measures as kind of the gateway and the vehicle to open up in a prudent way. But when states try to open, and California is not alone in this, I mean, it certainly is not a sole California issue. We're seeing the same thing in Florida, the same thing in Arizona, the same thing in Texas. We have to regroup and take a look at why we need to be quite prudent and careful as we do a step-by-step approach towards opening.
Dr. Fauci, it seems that all across the country, increasingly, so many aspects of this pandemic and our response to it are becoming politically charged. Talk, if you would, about the challenges that that presents for you, especially in terms of messaging.
Yeah, I mean, obviously it is a challenge. I mean, we try to the best of our ability to get out there. I do, at least, spending a lot of time trying to get the facts and the data and the evidence to the American people so that they can see that what we're talking about really does make sense from a public health standpoint. Some of the things that we've got to continue to emphasize is that no matter where you are, at what stage you are in opening, the issues that are pretty simple, the physical distancing, the avoiding crowds, the 6 feet distancing, the wearing masks at all times. You know, outdoors is always better than indoors. You know, when one of the things you risk when you have people congregate, you know, in homes or in restaurants with the circulation, which is clearly a contribution to the way viruses are spread. These are the things we've got to be careful of. Yes, it is very frustrating, but we have to try and keep getting the message out.
So Major League Baseball is back. They've resumed training, even as dozens of players test positive. Others say they're not willing to risk playing at all. Is it a mistake, do you think, to try to have Major League Baseball? I mean, is it realistic to think they can really play a season, even with all these safety protocols in place?
Well, you know, they are trying to do this with the safety of the players involved. So this is something that the management of Major League Baseball is struggling with, you know, the situation of creating a bubble where you test everybody and you keep them protected and sequestered from the possibility of exposure inadvertently, particularly from people who are without symptoms. And you continue to monitor them and do surveillance on a regular basis. It could be done. It's tricky. You know, it is tricky. I mean, they have come to me and to other health officials to get advice. We give them the facts, and they're going to have to make up their own mind and their own decision of whether this is going to be doable or not. It looks like right now it is on the track of doing the kind of shortened and abbreviated season that they're aiming for. I mean, I hope that they do it and they do it successfully.
Doug asked you about baseball. Does your advice change if we talk football? I mean, golf is underway. There's talking about the NBA doing it in the bubble in Florida. Or is the advice the same across the board?
Well, you know, there are some common denominators that are the same, but there are some things that are different by the very nature of the sport. I mean, something you could not possibly get a more contact sport than football, where literally on every single play there's contact. So that's, therefore, you really have got to monitor the players very, very closely and carefully, because that could spread very easily if someone is infected and doesn't realize they're infected. But the whole idea of doing some form of a lockdown where the players are tested very regularly, and then you have to ask the question, it's looking at it from the perspective of the players and those around the players, the managers and those who, you know, do the services with the players. But then you got to look at, what about spectators? That's the other aspect of it. Do you want to have a sport that is only being seen on television, or do you want to have spectators that are essentially diminished in their number so that you could have the proper and safe spacing? All of these things are being considered, and they differ from sport to sport, whether you are outdoors in a stadium or indoors in an arena, such as with basketball games. You know, it gets very complicated with, as I mentioned, with some common denominators and some commonalities, but other things that are different because it's specific for the given sport that you're talking about.
Dr. Fauci, the average age of new coronavirus patients has dropped significantly, more than a decade,
yeah.
I believe.
Yeah, a decade and a half younger.
A decade and a half. Talk about how that changes the dynamic of the response.
Well, it changes the dynamics because what it is that in, back when things were really on fire, particularly in the Northeast, significantly different from what you all have, you know, in California. But when that was happening, it was, you know, outbreaks in nursing homes, people of multiple ages, particularly some of the elderly getting infected. Right now, what you see is you see younger people getting infected, as we mentioned, a decade and a half younger, which means the likelihood of they immediately getting ill enough to require hospitalizations is much less likely. We still get young people, otherwise healthy, who are getting seriously ill. So they're not completely, protected from that. But when you get young people who are getting infected, you may need to see a couple of generations of infections before you get to the vulnerable people. So assume you have a fundamentally young group at a bar and at a gathering. They can get infected. So the numbers of infections go up. What's going to lag is the hospitalizations, and then with the hospitalizations would lag the deaths. So that right now we're seeing a surge of infections. But, you know, when you look at the data and you examine it carefully, I mean, I'll give you some example. Like in Texas, we just went over this. I just got back from the White House where we went over the numbers. You know, for example, in Texas, in Austin, hospitalizations were up 300%, and the ICUs were up 270%. So it isn't without serious illness that some of these people are getting infected. And I guess the question is, we always say protect the vulnerable, and the vulnerable are the senior citizens and those of any age who have underlying conditions that predispose them to a serious outcome. And we know what they are, you know, heart disease, hypertension, diabetes, things like that. Ultimately, if those people wind up getting infected as the second or third generation from the initial young people that get infected, then we're going to have a serious problem again with a degree of morbidity and mortality that we hope does not happen. So when you have a young person getting infected, they think it's inconsequential to them because the likelihood that they're not going to be bothered by this, which is true, the fact is they're part of the process of the propagation of the outbreak because innocently and inadvertently, they may be infecting someone else who is vulnerable to the more morbid and more risk of a fatal outcome.
We're talking with Dr. Anthony Fauci, in case you're just joining us. He's live on an extended edition this afternoon of the State of California. Talking about younger people getting infected, I'm the parent of a couple of school-age kids, and I'm quite anxious about my kids going back to school this fall. Three of my siblings are teachers. They're anxious for a different reason. I know you're very proud of your three daughters, and one of them is a school teacher. What are you telling her about whether it's safe to be back at school this fall?
Yeah, you know, this is a very difficult situation because we have to try, always with safety being paramount in our mind, as best as possible to get the schools open again. And the reason is that the unintended secondary consequences of closing schools, and then what happens to the children, what happens to the parents who now have no one to take care of the children, it's a ripple effect that, you know, sometimes you have to just, you know, bite the bullet and bear it. But to the best of our attempts, we should try to get the schools open, not carelessly in the sense of putting anybody at any severe danger. But the question you're talking about really relates to what the level of viral activity is in the school district that you are. And that really varies, particularly for a state as large as California, where you may have certain counties where there's very little infection activity and it has very little impact on the schools. But there may be some counties where the activity of virus is such that you might want to pause and think about, is there any modification of the school schedule that you're thinking of? I mean, you're right. One of my daughters is a school teacher. She's not in California. She's in New Orleans, and they're struggling with the same thing that you're saying, the safety of the students, and what about the teachers? The teachers, some of whom are vulnerable because of age or because of underlying condition, this is going to get complicated as we approach the school year beginning.
I have another question relating to children and that unintended ripple effect, and that is, today I was reading about in Texas, 1,300 people tested positive related to hundreds of child care facilities in Texas. Now, most of them were workers, but there were a significant amount also who were kids. How concerned are you about that?
No, I mean, obviously I am concerned about that, because anytime you have a situation where you have a propagation of infection above the ordinary, intermittent infections that you might see in a community. But when you have a locus, a physical location where you can have the spread of infection, you've got to be very concerned about that. You know, I don't have an easy answer for you because, as you said, there's ripple effects. Either way, you keep the kids out of school, they either go home, the parents need to stay home. What about the child care centers? It gets very complicated, which gets back down to what we said in an earlier part of the interview. We've all got to take very seriously what we as individuals can do to stop the spread of infection by essentially adhering to some fundamental public health approaches of the things that we keep talking about over and over again, the physical distancing, washing of hands, wearing of masks. That goes a long way to solve a lot of the problems we're talking about right now.
I want to shift gears, Dr. Fauci, and ask you about the latest on vaccines. It can be very confusing to those of us lay people out here just trying to make sense of the headlines and who is saying what about when we're going to see something actually on the market and available to Americans and folks worldwide. What do you want us to know?
Yeah, well, I think what people need to appreciate and understand is that there is never a guarantee that you're going to have a safe and effective vaccine. I mean, that's just the way vaccine and vaccine development is. However, the early preliminary studies, both in animals and in the phase one study in humans of multiple different candidates. Now, remember, there's not just one vaccine that's being developed. You know, here in the United States, there's almost a half a dozen at least that are being now at various stages of development. If things go the way we hope they do, without any glitches, as we proceed from phase one study, there's vaccines in phase two studies, one of the candidates is going to go into what's called phase three, namely trying to determine if it's effective or not, somewhere at the end of this month of July, and another will come in at the end of August, and then as we get into September. If all goes well, and we do get one that's effective, we should know that it is or is not, and hopefully it will be effective sometime by the end of this calendar year, the beginning of 2021. So that's something that we have an aspirational hope for, that there will be at least one candidate, and then after that, maybe and hopefully one or more others, so that as we get into the end of this year and 2021, that the companies that are developing these vaccines with government subsidizing is starting to already produce doses that would be used if, in fact, the vaccine turns out to be effective. So you could get a head start on it so that hopefully, if everything works out all right, that sometime by the end of the year and the beginning of 2021, we'll have some doses that are available. And as we get into 2021, the companies promise that many of them would have hundreds of millions of doses available as we go through 2021. Again, that's all predicated on the fact that we're successful in getting a safe and effective vaccine, of which I mentioned there's some cautious optimism about that, but there's never a guarantee, which gets us back to what we are left with and will always have is good public health measures, which we need to really focus on and concentrate on.
How concerned are you that when there is a vaccine, a significant percentage of people won't trust it, they'll refuse to get the shot? That was a real issue in California when we had a measles outbreak. There's a large anti-vaccine movement. How concerned are you about that? And if that happens, how effective it'll be in helping us achieve immunity?
Yeah, well, that's a great question. And it is an area of considerable concern on my part, as well as the part of my public health colleagues. So the way we can hopefully get around that and mitigate that real issue of, you know, a pushback on the part of a certain segment of our society, you know, it's kind of an anti-authoritative feeling, an anti-science feeling, an anti-government feeling, whatever you want to call it. There is a certain segment of society that's very skeptical about vaccines that are being recommended. The way we're already starting to get around that is we've got to do a very strong effort in what we call community engagement. Get the community involved, meet with them at the level that they trust, to get community workers to go out there with us and explain the facts about why it's important to get vaccinated. You know, we have a very strong network throughout the country of engagement and community programs that relates to the now decades-old work that we've done in the treatment and prevention of HIV. And we're going to leverage some of those assets that were so successful in getting the community involved in the kinds of clinical trials and treatments and preventions that we've done for so many years with HIV. Among other things, we've got to engage the minority community, because it is very important to get the minority community, African American, Latinx, and Native Americans, to get the vaccine, because as a matter of fact, they, on the basis of the comorbidities that they have, they are much more likely to have a serious negative outcome were they to get infected with this coronavirus. Therefore, it's very important that we protect them with a vaccine, but we've got to convince them that the vaccine is for their benefit and get them vaccinated, as opposed to being skeptical and shying away from the vaccine trials.
Pushback aside from the psychology of getting people to get vaccinated once the vaccine is available, how concerned are you about whether, in fact, that vaccine will be affordable to everybody and it would be available? I mean, how do you go about prioritizing who gets it?
Well, that's a very good point. We are putting together, under the auspices of, you know, not only our own trialists, but the National Academy of Medicine, to help us to get ethicists together, to get trialist community representatives to work out a way that when the vaccine becomes available, and it's not going to become available all at once, that the people get it who are the highest priority, who would need it. And those are predominantly the people who are most vulnerable to the negative and deleterious consequences of getting infected. And we know those people. They are people who are elderly, people who have underlying conditions, also healthcare workers who are going to be putting themselves on the line every day at risk to take care of people who are infected. So the prioritization will be done with all the appropriate ethical considerations.
Dr. Fauci, if the pandemic continues on its present trajectory in California the way it's been and in other places where it's rising, Florida, Arizona, Texas, and keeps spreading like this, what do we do next? Do we go back to sheltering in place? Do we revoke all of the reopening we did? I mean, what is the next step?
Yeah, we hope we don't have to go to a complete lockdown again for a number of reasons, because I think that would be, you know, the morale of people would be really very, very clearly negatively impacted by that. It is possible that may have to come about, But what you're starting to see now in the states that you just mentioned, and perhaps even in other states that are now becoming more vulnerable about approaching the kind of thing we're seeing in the states that are being hardest hit, is not necessarily a lockdown, but now being mandated, like mandating masks, closing bars, not allowing congregations of more than a certain number of people. Before, it was left to the discretion of the local leaders to do that. But right now, what we're seeing in several of these states is that the governors and the mayors are seeing that it's a serious enough problem that they're now mandating things as opposed to saying that they're discretionary.
Dr. Fauci, if I might wrap things up on a broad note here, there are a lot of folks out there who are feeling somewhat of a COVID-19 fatigue, if you will, as I can imagine you and your colleagues are. What is your message to them in terms of looking at this as a marathon, how best to navigate it, where to turn for reliable information and so forth?
Yeah, that's a very good question. And I think one of the things that we need to emphasize more is that we will get through this. This will end. What we want to avoid is people throwing up their hands and saying, well, you know, this is just going to go on, and I'm just, you know, going to throw caution to the wind because who cares? That would be very dangerous. We're all in this together. I mean, that's something that sometimes when you're as an individual, you kind of think you're operating in a vacuum. We're all interconnected. By protecting ourselves, we're protecting society, and by society protecting itself, they're protecting us. We're going to get through this. This will end. It will end from public health measures, and the science will help us get there with treatments and vaccines. We've just got to hang in there and just realize that we will get successfully through this. It's going to take a while. It's not going to be tomorrow. It's not going to just disappear. It's going to be controlled, but we're going to have to be part of the solution, not part of the problem.
Thank you so much for taking some time to be with us this afternoon. I know it's the evening back east. Dr. Anthony Fauci, Director of the National Institute of Allergy and Infectious Diseases, a member of the President's Coronavirus Task Force. Thanks for being with us. And again, folks, you can hear the State of California every weekday at 3:30 p.m. It's also available at kcbsradio.com and wherever you get your podcasts. Thanks, Patty and Jeff. I'm Doug Sovereign, KCBS.
Hey, Rob Bradford here. I have set out on a mission with my good friends at FanDuel to prove what I have known for some time. Baseball isn't boring. Now I have a daily podcast to prove it with some of the most notable people in the baseball world screaming baseball isn't boring from the mountaintops, or at least agreeing to come on our show. Players, managers, GMs, and yes, even the commissioner of baseball, Rob Manfred. It has been a constant wave of baseball's most powerful voices. So join the revolution. Subscribe and soak in Baseball Isn't Boring. Listen on your Odyssey app or wherever you get your podcasts. You'll be glad you did.